If you want to hear a great discussion about game design, learn about a cool new indie game company, and hear about one of the best puzzle games that I've ever played, then you're going to want to sit down, put the iPod on lock, and settle in, because I recently got a chance to talk with Chris Park of Arkham Games about their new puzzle game, Tidalis. It's a fantastic interview. It's got a lot of great insights on game design and storytelling and gameplay, and some of the indie sensibilities that we maybe don't see as much as we would like to in some of the larger studio releases. So sit back and have a listen. Hey, what's going on? This is Jordan, and today I am especially excited because I have a fantastic guest with me today. Joining me today is Chris Park, who is the founder, CEO, and lead designer for an indie game company called Arkham Games. And he's here with us today to talk about their new puzzle game on the PC called Tidalis. So, Chris, thanks for coming on with me today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I always kind of like to start with breaking in stories. I promise we'll get to Tidalis, but I think one of the interesting things about gaming, especially with indie developers, is we don't always get to hear a lot about how people like yourself get started in different industries like film or comic books, which is another industry that I'm really interested in. We always kind of hear this stuff. That's one of the most talked about things is how people get into it. But in games, you kind of never really get to hear those interesting stories of folks like yourself. So I guess the first question is just how did you get into this? How did you actually start doing this in terms of making games?
Well, I mean, I think like with a lot of indie developers, it was a kind of slow thing over time. I did this for more than a decade, close to two decades, I guess, in terms of hobbyist stuff. I started making levels for Demon Stalkers back when I was like 11, and like 1992 or something like that. That's not when I was 11, but at any rate, I guess like 9 or 11, something like that. It was a cool game, late 80s type game, and it had a level editor, and that was just the coolest thing ever. And I wound up playing that game way more than any other game I'd ever played, just because I could make my own stuff and make my own levels, and so I did. And from there on, it was kind of like any time a game had a level editor, that was very interesting. So I did like Unlimited Adventures, the Dungeons and Dragons RPG creation thing back in the AOL days. We'd post our levels and quests on AOL and other people would play them and stuff like that. And I did some stuff with Grawl, and I did levels for Quake 2 and for Counter-Strike, all sorts of just random various genres and stuff. And after doing that for a long time and releasing just kind of hobbyist mod type stuff for free, or playing with it with friends, you get a sense of what people like, what they don't like, what people respond well to, that sort of thing. And so it's just kind of on the job training is a hobby, I guess. And I really didn't get into programming too much until the early 2000s. I'd done a little bit of stuff in like QBasic way back and made a couple of games, like a text adventure game and stuff, and they were embarrassingly bad. I didn't even release those to anybody, but I didn't get serious into real programming until probably 2002 or so. And then I started working on games. I'd always wanted to make a Mario Brothers clone, so I was working on that, and did that using graphics that they'd pull from there. But of course, that's an enormous copyright violation, so I couldn't release that. But I learned a lot about actually making games and duplicating some of the physics that they have in those games and things like that. And then I was just working on projects like that kind of privately for a while, and then eventually I started working actually on Alden Ridge, and in 2008, spent 8 months working on that, got kind of stuck as a side project, decided to make AI work, because I was really frustrated with all of the RTS offerings as far as co-op went. They just weren't doing what I wanted to do, so I was like, fine, I'll make one myself. This is the way that I want to play. So spent 7 months on that, and then that turned into obviously way more than a side project, and by the time that was getting kind of close to being done, I was like, this is actually a product I could actually sell and make a commercial thing. So I formed Arkin in March of 2009 after having been working on the game for already like 4 or 5 months, and then released it. I did no publicity or anything like that beforehand whatsoever, so of course like nobody bought it the first couple of weeks. It's just, you know, crickets for 2 weeks. We had literally no sales, and then you know, finally started getting some notice and got on Stardock's Impulse platform because one of their guys there saw it and liked it, and then, you know, it was onwards and upwards from there. It was kind of a snowball effect over time. You know, it took us like 4 months or something to get our first 1,000 sales, which is pretty good for an indie game, you know. And then I think now it's up to like, I don't know, 30,000 some units sold, if you count the expansion. And you know, that was then, you know, onwards and upwards with other games from there. So certainly not the last thing we're going to do, Tide Alice either.
Yeah, you bring up a really interesting point as the starting point in terms of, like, you know, map editors or level editors or things like that. You know, you're actually not the first video game developer who I've heard mention that as being kind of an entry point for them. This is kind of like a little side note. I was actually just watching some of the videos on Bungie's new Forge World that they're going to be doing in the Halo Reach release that's coming up this fall, and I was talking with a buddy of mine about some of the stuff that's in The Witcher, which we were talking about before we started recording in terms of their adventure editor. Are you familiar with some of the current, you know, generation stuff that we have right now, also with Dragon Age and some of the things that people can do using existing games to make their own stuff? And do you think that even today that's still a viable way for someone to kind of get started if they maybe wanted to get into the industry?
Well, I must confess I haven't really touched anybody's level editor other than, you know, ones I've coded myself since probably 2003, because you know, my big frustration with level editors historically was, you know, as good as they were and so forth, you know, you're editing levels and that's about it. And, you know, maybe you can add in some like scripting and stuff, but you're still very much at the mercy of the core game design of somebody else, right? So my whole thing with why I wanted to start doing, you know, games that were entirely my own was that, you know, I wanted to make games that were entirely my own. I wanted to make all the design decisions for better or for worse. So once you've started doing that, then and once you're able to do that and practiced at it, it's not much incentive to use other people's engines or, you know, map editors in the same sense. Now, that said, you know, I've certainly seen a lot of the game engines and stuff and looked at them from a point of curiosity, but I haven't you know, use them directly. I mean, like the Unreal 3 engine's pretty interesting just to look at. And obviously, if I was going to make a 3D game of that nature, starting from the basis of an engine like that is, you know, you're crazy not to. You don't want to reinvent the wheel every time with something like that. But, you know, I think certainly for people who want to make games or mods and stuff, at least for making games itself, it's never been easier to get into that because, you know, you've got things like Unity 3D and XNA and, you know, even stuff like the Games Factory thing, I forget what it's called, but, you know, you've got all these various products, Torque, all that sort of stuff. And I've looked into most of those a lot more significantly because they're a little more freeform and not tied to any particular, you know, game or mechanics. But, you know, it's definitely a good time to be ready to break into stuff.
Okay, cool. Now, as for Titleist, your latest release, you know, for people who might not have already played it, who maybe aren't familiar with it, can you just kind of give us the basic idea of, you know, what is Titleist? What's it all about?
Sure. Titleist is basically a puzzle game that it's a, you know, a block-based puzzle game, but it uses a new mechanic rather than being like a match three type game like Bejeweled or similar. You know, you do wind up, you know, matching three blocks a lot of times here, but, you know, if you only match three, that's pretty lame actually in this game. But you basically, all the blocks have colors and arrow directions, and you drag the arrows around so they make little paths between each color. And the blocks don't have to be right next to one another. They're just, as long as they're within three spaces of one another, you can still chain them together. And then once you've got a little path that you want, you set off what we call a stream through there. And they follow the path, the blocks disappear. Hopefully you've got, you know, half a dozen or a couple of dozen even blocks in a chain. And then when those fall, then more streams emit. You can set up some pretty crazy combos with that. And you know, we've got an adventure mode with 115 levels that you can play through with with various different objectives, win and loss objectives all through there, with a story through there, and with we've got a couple of dozen different special blocks that alter the play field in various ways, and then 20 game modes which do things like mess with gravity or change the rules. There's water in the bottom of it coming up and things float, all that sort of thing. So there's all this variety and just this kind of incredible milieu of kind of layers upon layers on top of that core concept with the arrows and the streams.
What initially inspired you guys to do a puzzle game?
Well, we actually started working on this, Lars and I did. Lars Bull is the lead designer on this one. He's the one who came up with the original concepts and was overseeing design and so forth. I was the producer on this one, and I certainly helped with the design and designed a number of the special blocks and modes and stuff. In fact, other people on the team did too. It was a very much a collaborative effort with all five of us and some of the beta testers and so forth had some ideas that we used too. But anyway, Lars and I started talking about doing a puzzle game back June, July. AI War was freshly out then, and I was being kept busy with lots of free DLC and stuff for that, which is something we do periodically with AI War, and actually we're planning on doing with Ted Alice for that matter. But we thought, okay, it would be fun to do a puzzle game together because we both like those. We're both real big fans of Panel Depon, Planet Puzzle League, that sort of thing. And Lars was really into a lot of the kind of off-the-wall ones like Tetrasphere and Wetrix and stuff like that. I think they're off the wall. But so anyway, we thought, oh, let's spend like a month. We'll just develop out something real basic, nothing all that involved. And then, that'll be just kind of this, again, little side project for us, So it's like, okay, that'll be fun. We'll spend a month doing that, So we did spend a month working on prototypes. And the first prototypes that we did, I think, six prototypes. And the first, like, four, you wouldn't even recognize. You wouldn't have any clue that they were like Tidalis because it was basically, a top-down type view. You'd place Tetris-looking blocks, and this energy wave would emanate out from them, kind of like a shock wave, and it would, clear other colors that were nearby from that. I mean, it was literally like, shock waves coming in a pool of water or something off there. And, it was interesting, but it was just bloody hard, and it was not all that fun. Neither Lars nor I thought it was all that fun once we actually were playing it. So we kept kind of, reinventing it, and eventually went to this kind of side view thing where you've got blocks falling in, and they're single square blocks, not the kind of Tetris blocks. And we kept the idea of kind of shock waves, but instead of having it be omnidirectional, it was, directed with the streams. And that turned out to be, really fun. And, it was addicting some of the people that we showed it to, pretty quickly, where they didn't want to stop playing it when we were just showing them that. And it was, we had like no art. It was like art that I did. It was terrible. And, it was, really, really rough. And so that kind of got put on hold then for a good long while, because we did AI War 2.0, and we did then the Zenith Remnant expansion to AI War. And then, Tidalis was going to be the next project after that, and we were actually going to have, a real artist working on it, and, our composer actually working on it, and we're going to do out, an adventure mode, and, all this sort of stuff. And the project just kind of grew and grew and grew. And so it wound up taking us another 6 months of development, past the prototype stage, which was longer than I'd planned. I'd been hoping for four, but part of it was that we decided to switch platforms mid-project from, SlimDX and stuff on the Windows side over to Unity 3D so that we could, have Mac support and an easier install process and all that sort of thing. And so that kind of set us back some, but very much well worth it. And so that's kind of how it came about. I thought it would be nice to do a puzzle game. My first thought, partly because I wanted to do one and I wanted to do a game with Lars, and he had lots of puzzle ideas, whereas that's just not something I have a lot of broad concepts for. And so it'd be fun to work together on that. And I really wanted to not get typecast as a strategy developer, because I could tell it was just oozing out of all the reviews and player comments. People think, "Oh, you're a strategy developer. You're a strategy developer." And I'm like, "No, I happened to make a strategy game first, but I'd been working on an adventure game before that, and most of the games that I've worked with in the past have been either adventure games, platformers, a lot of FPS stuff. I did stuff with, Duke Nukem 3D, as well as the other ones I'd already mentioned, and Unreal Tournament. It's like, I don't want to be thought of as a strategy developer, but this is the first strategy game I've ever done. It's the first thing I release. You guys assume that's all I do, but, that's not what I want to be known for, as much as I enjoy strategy games, so."
Yeah, and I know that's actually one of the interesting things that I kind of noticed. I think this isn't the first time you've said that you don't want to get typecast. You want to do different types of genres other than puzzle games, and maybe other than some of the other titles that you've already announced. Is there any kind of genre that you haven't worked on that you would like to work on?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much any 2D genre I'm usually pretty much a fan of. I'm not that much into sports games, with a few exceptions. I mean, I like, some of the ones like Blitz Football, or some of the like Wii Sports or whatever, but they're not things I would just sit down and play a lot. And I'm not really into like fighting games like Street Fighter or whatever. I don't get into all the button combos and stuff. And some of the obvious things, like just the really super casual stuff, or My Pony Adventures or whatever, obviously I'm not into. But aside from that sort of thing, I like pretty much every genre. And I've always gone through life, saying, I would see Game X, let's say, and I'm like, "Oh, that concept sounds awesome. Man, I can't wait to play that." And then I would play it. It would be a fun game, usually, but be like, "Oh, that's what they meant? See, when I read the description of what this was going to be, I thought they meant, something else that was cooler in my mind." And it's like, "Oh." So I've kind of had just kind of a mental list of all these things where it's like, so and so did this, and they almost did this, which would have been cooler. Man, I wish I could go do that cooler idea that I had, at some point. So now I'm kind of, now that I have the means to do so, I'm kind of sweeping back through and stuff. I'm not really wanting to make much in the way of 3D games, because they're expensive to make and everybody's making them, and I don't really feel like I can compete there. I would like to make maybe a first person shooter at some time, and it might be fun to make a kart racer sometime, and those kind of, obviously have to be 3D. But other than those two genres, which I'm not even sure if I'll ever actually get to, I'm pretty much planning to stay 2D, so.
Okay, so Ty Dallas, this game, I think one of the most outstanding things about it, at least for me, is just that it has quite a bit of depth, particularly in the amount of just different game modes and variants. Talk about the challenge in creating that much variety. How did you guys expand so much on what is really a pretty simple core gameplay?
Well, I guess that's kind of our specialty, really. I mean, if you think about AI War too, that's a case where it's kind of overall simple thing. It's an RTS that's kind of a known area, and then we just went with all these different, riffs and so forth off of that core concept, and it became exceedingly complex through that. But so I guess that's sort of a tough question to answer, because that's just something that we do naturally. And certainly I've noticed that most developers don't do that naturally. There's other things they're better at than us. But I guess it's just a matter of we look at what we have, and then we think, okay, what else could we do with this? What if the streams didn't always go in a straight line? Well, okay, I guess that could be based on gravity. What if they, sank based on gravity? What if we had magnets that they kind of moved around? Things like that. So it's kind of like, okay, well, what else is different? Well, we can never move the blocks normally. That's a rule of Tidalis. You can't move the blocks. So what ways in which What ways could we, violate that with the game modes? You have things like jumping bean mode where you click the blocks and they jump upwards and you can do all these kind of crazy stunts, or you have the block swap one where, you click a block and not only does it shoot out the stream, but it moves in the direction the arrow is pointing, which kind of messes with all sorts of things. And so we're just kind of looking at, well, what do we have and how can we totally like do something that screws up the normal rules that we have, so that you get variety that way. And it's just kind of looking for ways to make things, we say, well, this is always the same. What if it wasn't? I guess is the way to explain it.
Okay, this might sound like kind of a strange question, but how did you guys know when to stop in terms of all the customization and all the different variants and modes and stuff? I mean, I know it might sound kind of strange, but it kind of feels like one of the concerns or maybe one of the reservations that some developers have is that, if you throw too much stuff in there, people are going to get overwhelmed, or there's not, people aren't even going to notice some of the little details in there. When you're putting that much variety into a game, I mean, how did you guys know what was the right amount of customization options? What was too much? What was too little? Or did you guys just want to throw as much as you could in there?
Well, a lot of that kind of comes down to experience, I guess. You just kind of get a sense for it. There's, and a lot of that comes from, we get, possibly like a couple of dozen emails or, forum posts a day with suggestions and comments from players on X, on AI War and, with comments and so forth on Tidalis too. So, we have this huge amount of feedback from players with wide varieties of demographics, different ages, different interests, all that sort of thing. They all have their own ways of, wanting to see things improved or added or changed or whatever. So with AI War, for example, one thing that you notice is there's just an explosion of options there. And with a strategy game for something that you play for a long, long time, dozen hours at a time or more, that was something that was really important. And that's like a super hardcore group of players and so forth, right? So we're like, okay, we'll just do everything in the kitchen sink. If somebody wants it and we have time and it's feasible and we can build it in without inconveniencing everybody else, we'll do it if there's time. That makes sense to us. That was kind of our tack there. And you wind up with something that's got, 100 lobby options and like, five tabs of settings with all these crazy options, you know what I mean? And hotkeys that, literally use every key on the keyboard plus, control and shift options and stuff. And that's fine for a super hardcore strategy game, but you're going to have a really niche audience if you do that. And, we knew that when we were going into Tidalis. So, compared to AI War, the number of customization options are pretty slight. Compared to other puzzle games, they're a lot more robust. I mean, there's a lot of things that many puzzle games don't do, like, do you want to change the screen resolution? Do you want to, do the blinking lights and stuff of just kind of the special effects bother you? That gives some people headaches. Let it so they can turn it off. Are you colorblind? There's a lot of colorblind people, and there's a lot of different ways of being colorblind. And that was something that we've had a lot of feedback on with AI War. And we can't, the violet versus green, or all these various things. So we've done a lot of tuning of AI War to make it so that things like colors were less of an issue there. So that was a natural thing that we wanted to carry over to Tidalis, and a big thing that people liked to have a lot of times is like key bindings. So, they want to be able to remap the keys because, especially on, some foreign keyboards, I've had German players who are like, you may think that hitting Alt A is easy because it's right next to it on your keyboard, but those are on opposite ends of the keyboards on ours. I have to use two hands to do it. Could you please not use Alt A? So, you run into all these sort of, questions and responses and, complaints from people with various, interests. And so we just kind of carried that forward into Tidalis and said, okay, what are the things we know that, are going to be usability concerns for people? Let's, colorblindness stuff, things with people that have epilepsy or, sensitivity to colors and, brightness and flashing and stuff. So have options to turn those things off. And then beyond that, it's just a matter of kind of, gameplay customization. And certainly, We kind of hedged and we made quick games where you can just kind of click in there. Like my mom uses this setting where it's like, you click into quick game, then you choose a single mode. You can't even combine them, and then you choose your music and background, and that's you're kind of off the races. You might set like a time limit, and that's it. Versus then, that was kind of our hedge versus the kind of full-blown custom games where you can mix and match all the modes. You can set how many colors are there. And there's about 20 different settings, maybe, I guess. And we just went with the ones that if we were playing somebody else's game that we would want to be able to tweak without it being stuff that you could tweak so heavily that you're just kind of modding the game, I guess. There's kind of a fine line there because, how fast do streams move and, what's the rate of gravity? Stuff like that, players don't really need to be tweaking. That really just changes the game fundamentally in a way that's not, it's not really adding anything new. It's just kind of messing with it, if you see what I mean. So we stayed away from stuff like that, and then with stuff where we said, okay, this would actually be different, legitimately different way to play. We went with that, and we had lots of ideas we didn't use. We had ideas for another half dozen, game modes, another four or five special blocks. We had even, that we had designed in detail. But at some point, and this happened with AI War too, where I had, 30 plus ship designs that in the 1.0 version weren't in there. At some point, you go, my gosh, this game is humongous. We really don't need to be adding any more content. We're getting a real low incremental value from this, and since ideas come to us every week anyway, we're never going to finish this project if we just keep going. So, all right, let's make this the final call. And then, of course, we added like two more game modes anyway because they were easy to program, and we wanted to have some special stuff at the end of the game at the adventure levels. So we're like, okay, well, these last two, that'll be it. So. And I think that actually turned from two to four because we had started with 16 game modes at the quote end and then wound up with actually 20. So it's kind of like, well, all right. So stuff has a way of sneaking in there, but it's just you build and it's like the guy who's kind of chipping at the block of marble, and you just chip away everything that doesn't look like an elephant. You kind of just have a sense of when you're done.
Yeah, you kind of actually answered my next question there in terms of was there any game modes or special blocks or anything that was left out? Is there anything that you guys are planning to add in the future with DLC?
We've got a couple of new game modes and stuff that'll be out next week, actually. With AI War, that's something where it's kind of under continuous development, and it sees just massive numbers of changes every month, and beta upon beta upon beta, and then an official version every couple of months. And we're small staff and can't afford to do that with every game that we do. We'd have to add a new programmer for every game we did, in addition to the existing programmers, and that would just be, unwieldy expensive. But with Tidalis, we're planning on doing, some new special blocks or game modes every couple of months, and we're probably going to start actually holding some contests for players to, submit their ideas and stuff. There's three kind of game mode type things. Two of them are actually player rule sets for versus modes, and then one's a game mode, if I recall, that I'm planning on putting into the first release, the first DLC release, and those were all player suggestions that I thought were cool, and several that were made after the game was released anyway. So that's something we like to try and do is incorporate things that were ideas by players, not just us. So.
Cool. One of the things I love about this game is it looks great. I mean, not just for a puzzle game, but period. It has a distinct art style, I think. How much did that matter for you guys? I know, graphics and visuals aren't a huge deal for puzzle games, but it's something that's kind of like a nice visual polish. Was that a big emphasis for you guys for the game to look as slick as it does?
Thanks. We really appreciate that. It was the, Phil, is, artist, and he's been, working away full time on this since, I guess January. And, we hadn't expected there to be so much art, and we hadn't expected there to be so much detailed art. This was a new way for him to work. He'd been doing a lot of 3D art and a lot of more kind of realistic stuff in the past. And he was showing me before we started on Tidalis some kind of mock-ups of some kind of more painterly type work that he'd been doing. I was like, wow, that's really cool. We should do that for Tidalis. And we did. And of course, it was pretty slow going right at the very start because it was new to him. And then after that, it was like, okay, the speed just kept going up and up, and he was getting really, much faster. And but at the same time, it was like, well, he wasn't able to get all the animations and stuff in there that he wanted. So if you played at all during the beta, you'll remember that in the earlier betas, the backgrounds and everything were just static. There was nothing moving. They were pretty, but compared to what the final game looked like, they were just, a lot more kind of not blah, just they didn't have life to them. They were flat. No animation. So what we decided to do was Phil was like, if we set aside a month at the end where I can just go back and just polish this stuff and add in animations and stuff, I think we'll have something really cool. And I was like, that sounds great to me. Let's do that. So, we spent all of, from June 1st on to really a month and a half is what it wound up being. Phil was just working away like crazy on all these animations and stuff, and the background scenes, which had been really cool looking already, they just came to life and just suddenly had this depth to them that was really something new. And Keith, the other programmer, and I were adding various animation capabilities. We made a little kind of scripting language where he could do stuff to, have like the pigs running around in the background or whatever, the waterfalls. And we did a lot of new stuff for us that was only possible partly because of the way that we were using Unity 3D for this, with a lot of UV texture animation and stuff. Most of the water effects are using things like that, and that's something we could never do in the past. So we wound up having a lot of new tools and just wanting to experiment with those, and made sure to give kind of fill the time and room that he needed to really put a lot of extra oomph into it. And I think that's something you don't see in some indie games just because it's expensive to have an artist working away on stuff like that. So unless you have an artist that's kind of a more of a partner in the game and has a vested interest in how it turns out and so forth. In other words, like royalty sharing type stuff. That's kind of a hard thing to come by unless you're just already wealthy and want to spend like Jonathan Blow, I guess, spent like $200,000 or something of his own money on making Braid, and obviously that's a lot. So in our case, having Phil be a core member of the team really helped us emphasize that.
What would you say was the biggest challenge in making this game? Was there anything particularly difficult or tough to deal with during development?
Well, I will tell you, switching platforms right in the middle, that's I'm glad we did it and the time was right to do it, and I'm very glad that we did it, but whew, that was a tough month and a half there, 'cause the language was even the same, but the API and everything was entirely different. And not only were you learning the new API, but we had, fears about would it perform as well? Could we get the same sort of performance out of it? Is it going to be flexible enough for everything that we wanted to do? And we've vetted out a bunch of stuff. We looked at a bunch of different platforms and eventually decided on Unity after that. But then even once we'd had that kind of go decision, and bought the thing, it's like, well, you're not going to know if it's everything that you hope it's going to be until you're finished porting the entire game that you're planning to do, because that's when you can see, the performance and the functionality and stuff. And that created a lot of slowdowns for us, because we had to build a whole new graphical user interface system there, because we'd been using GDI, the graphical desktop interface from Windows for like AI War and stuff. And so, and the animation system was completely different. The way the music and the sound systems were completely different and stuff. And it's good changes, but whew, that is a tough thing to undertake when you've got a sense of a deadline and are basically taking a month out of that process or more to do a port all of a sudden.
One of the things that I actually really wanted to ask about, but I forgot to jot down on my notes, is this game obviously does have an adventure mode. It has a very sort of a tight, contained story. It doesn't seem like it's a huge necessarily undertaking in terms of the plot. But can you just kind of talk about where this story kind of came from? This very light story that's injected in there. I like it. It's kind of weird. It's kind of odd in a good way. I mean, where did this idea come from exactly?
Well, we. Originally I was going to write the story on my own because, I like to write, and that's, I've written a couple of novels that, aren't publication worthy or anything, but that, I've been around the block with that sort of thing. And, I was like, I'm going to write this, this is going to be great. And then the problem is I write very, very dark. I mean, I have a habit of killing off the protagonist in my book, I write pretty dark stuff. And so, my ideas were along the lines of, oh, let's have a Tidalis is an island where people that get sucked out to sea from riptides wind up on this island, and they're not dead, they're just kind of in this mystical limbo, and people from all these, and they come from different time periods. You've got people from like the future and the past and all this sort of stuff, they're all there, and then as soon as one of them agrees to die so the others can live, then they all get out of there, and the one person washes up dead on the shore and the other people get rescued. It's like, okay, and then we had one where it's like, oh, this is an alien planet called Tidalis, and humans have colonized it, but they only live underwater, and they think there's no surface land, but then all of a sudden they discover there is this, island, and stuff like this, and it's like, okay, well, these are all kind of weighty, and, this is a puzzle game. We want it to be rated E. We want this to be something that, if your five-year-old kid wants to play this, that there's not a thematic reason that he can't. Certainly it's a very deep game, but it's one that's also, casually accessible, which is what we were going for. And, having a story that's at odds with that is not good. So we're like, okay, this needs to be lightweight. Let's try and do something funny. I like funny stuff as well. I mean, I love, Galaxy Quest, Monty Python, that sort of stuff. Let's try and kind of lampoon some of what goes on in, puzzle games and just kind of adventure stories in general. What can we do with that? So, my wife and I, she's also a writer, we worked on that together. We did all the, the plotting and stuff together, and then she actually wrote it and scripted out the cutscenes, because the other thing that it turned out was, gosh, I'm busy with all the producing and all the programming and all this porting stuff, and that month of porting sucked up all the time that I would have had for any writing. So, she wound up actually doing the writing, and, not every day, but towards the end every day, we'd, go around and, go on a walk and, talk about, what we thought, would make sense for the plot and this, that, and the other. And, it's a shame. I think some reviewers, play through like the first 20 levels or something of the adventure and then kind of write it off as far as the story goes. And you see, I don't know, 6-8 cutscenes maybe there at the most. And, there's like 40 plus cutscenes in all. And it starts out lighter, and it is light the whole way through. There's no question. And it's, it's all about, it's kind of a comedy of manners with an ensemble cast of these really goofy, characters. But there's a lot of funny lines in there. And a lot of the best stuff comes later in the story, after the characters are more introduced and everything. So it is a shame. I'm hoping to see some, reviews from, reviewers that get all the way through. But I mean, it's a long game if you play all the way through it. So I think they kind of started out, go, oh, okay, I get it. It's silly. Fine. End of story, write review. But so it goes.
How big is story for you in games? I mean, obviously you've kind of made the strategy game and then this puzzle adventure game. Is there anything, do you have a desire to kind of do something maybe more heavily story driven in the future?
Yeah, for sure. I really think that it's a ripe medium for doing kind of interactive fiction. I don't think anybody has fully nailed all of what we can do. I mean, you've got a lot of interesting things like Heavy Rain and stuff lately, obviously. And, there's a lot of things with kind of dialogue trees and stuff, and certainly what's that other one? The what's that?
Alan Wake, maybe?
Oh yeah, Alan Wake. I was thinking of Mass Effect
Mass
actually.
Effect, yeah.
You know, those ones, you know, they're really doing some interesting new things with narrative, and I think that's great. There's a certain amount of linearity you get out of having or a certain amount of scope creep, one or the other. You get to choose. You either get the scope creep or you get the linearity when you have too much like actual written narrative with a game. And you know, we can't, we're trying to kind of do our more gameplay focused projects first and then do later on some of the more narrative focused ones once we have frankly the money to be able to say, okay, let's just work on this one game for a year, year and a half with six people working on it, and no problem, we can, you know, all live off our income for that period. And right now, you know, that's not the case where we can just do that. So you know, for that reason, you know, I'm not a fan as much of kind of linear stuff. You know, AI War is obviously very branching, and Alden Ridge is going to be as well. So we tried to stay, you know, less story focused. With Tidalis, we're having a linear adventure because it's kind of a, it's really kind of a different genre. So we wanted to do a fun linear story that would go along with it, but that's kind of off the beaten track for us. And you know, I think, you know, there's been some interesting articles on like Gamma Sutra recently and stuff about, you know, where they make a good point where, you know, the narrative and the story is a lot more than the writing. You know what I mean? In especially like an adventure game, let's say, or something like that. You know, even the art and the music and so forth is part of, you know, the narrative, the story that is unfolding here. And you've got, you know, the plot and what's going on, and you've got just kind of the atmosphere and how that makes you feel. You know, I really love Silent Hill 2, and my favorite parts are just wandering around in the town and just how oppressive that is and how that makes you feel, even before you get into all the really, you know, head-bending story stuff with that game. And so, yeah, I think it's important, but I think there's a lot of different ways that can be approached, and I think it has to be approached right.
With Tidalis specifically, do you have a favorite you know, element in the game? Is there a favorite game mode, or just anything that you specifically appreciate as a player?
I really think the progression of the adventure mode is really cool. You know, Lars did all the levels for that, and he really did them in an unexpected way, I found. I had been expecting something kind of more repetitive, I guess, which is what you wind up with in most puzzle games. You know, I won't name any names, but it's a lot of times just the same thing over and over again, and it gets harder. And that's kind of what I expected. And what became, you know, clear as he was designing all these out, you know, he was spending, you know, 4 and 5 hours plus per level on just the initial design on these things. I was like, wow, that's a lot of time on these, and you're really doing this in a way that I hadn't expected. And I thought the end result was just really cool because it's so varied all the way through. I mean, you know, there's 115 levels, and none of them have, you know, the same feel at all. So I thought that was unexpected.
A couple days ago, while I was playing Tidalis, with somebody was standing over my shoulder watching me play, and I was explaining it to them. And the comment that they kind of made that kind of surprised me was, "Do they make it for the iPhone?" And I go, "You know, I don't think so." And they go, "Well, are they ever going to make it for the iPhone?" And I said, "Well, you know what? I'll ask that question."
Maybe is
Maybe.
the answer. I mean, I have an iPhone. I just got an iPhone 4, actually. I love it.
Excellent. Same here, actually.
Oh yeah. So I mean, it's really cool. You know, there's one main problem, I guess, with the iPhone for a game like Tidalis specifically, is that there's a lot on that screen. You know what I mean? The blocks, if you think about how that would, how many blocks there are and stuff, and translating that to the iPhone, those are going to be some darn small blocks. And trying to get your thumbs on those blocks to rotate them, and then, you know, clicking somewhere else to kind of fire them and stuff, that may not feel real great. You know what I mean? It's not like you can move a cursor around. I mean, we could do it with a virtual cursor, but I think that would, then you're taking up screen real estate, and that doesn't really. I haven't really enjoyed the virtual cursor on the iPhone much because it's not that tactile feedback that lets you know where your thumb is. So I'm always getting off of it, and then it's like, why isn't he going left? Oh, my thumb has moved. But I think potentially the iPad might be even more interesting for this, just because it's bigger. And there is, it runs at, I think, 1024 by 768, which is perfect. We don't even have to resize the art assets. So it's maybe. We would like to do something like that. There's also been that whole stink with, Apple and their new OS 4 license restrictions and stuff, and how that affects Unity 3D and all that sort of thing. And it seems like it's okay. But Apple's never said one way or the other, and Unity is certainly proceeding ahead with assuming that it's okay. But we're not sure that we want to invest the time into developing that, and then finding out that Apple like pulls the plug on Unity or something. So we're kind of biding our time on that, as well as just kind of waiting and seeing. But I certainly would love to have it on my phone, though. I mean, I've got a number of games on my phone. I really enjoy it, so.
All right, folks, you heard it here first. That's a maybe for Ty Dallas on the iPhone or iPad, maybe. Moving on here, you guys, you mentioned AI War, a number of times in the interview. You guys are probably still best known for that, along with now Ty Dallas. So you've got strategy and you've got puzzle. I know you've said you want to, not get pegholed into any one genre, but can you see yourself returning to either of those genres in the future, maybe beyond just expansions, doing another strategy game or another different puzzle game ever?
I think pretty definitely, but probably not for 3 or 4 years at least. And in the case of strategy, probably not for 5+ years. Mainly because with strategy games, AI War is robust, and we're working to make it even more robust. And we plan more expansions and all that sort of thing. And I feel like with an RTS game, it always. I've played several dozen RTS games on the PC over the years. I mean, hardcore played them, and I was always exciting to move to another game. But at the same time, it's kind of sad because it's like, this game had X interface element that I just loved, and now this new game doesn't have it. Or oh, I really liked these whatever other mechanics in the old game, and the new one doesn't have it. So with AI War, my goal has been to kind of have everything that I want in a strategy game all in one place there. And it pretty much already does as far as I'm concerned. But, adding on more variety and making the AI have new things it can do and all that sort of thing kind of makes it kind of a living game, which is important to me. So at any rate, the whole purpose of doing expansions, given that, is that it's nice because it's cheaper for us, it's cheaper for the customer to buy it, and best of all, the customer gets to keep all of their prior content. So instead of buying a sequel and being back to square one, they buy an expansion for less, and then wind up having everything they had before plus all this new stuff, which is like, then it's just kind of this compounding effect of the amount of content they get. So, a long time in the future, I would like to do some sort of turn-based strategy game, which would obviously be pretty different from AI War being real time, even though it has kind of a turn-based feel to it sometimes. But I really I don't see doing a sequel to AI War or anything. It's just going to be expansions and that's it, and then do something really different with the next strategy game someday. But we're headed to adventure and platformer and RPG and tower defense and stuff like that, first.
Yeah, I do want to touch briefly on some of the other titles that you guys have coming up. In particular, I'm highly intrigued by a game you guys have announced called Alden Ridge, which you've mentioned a couple of times. I think you said you've been working on that since even before AI Wars. Can you tell people a little bit about Alden Ridge and maybe give us an update on how things are coming with that title?
Sure. I worked on that for about 8 months in 2008, so it was about 80% done, I would say, at the time. And it's very, primitive graphics, just what I could either get for free or make myself. We didn't even have a composer then. It was just me. So it was using free music and sound and art and all that sort of stuff. And so, obviously pretty low production values. It was a fun game, but some of the gameplay could have been tighter too. And the reason I stopped working on it at the time was because it had started out as just kind of a isolated level type adventure type puzzle game. I mean, you were exploring around in the individual level, and you'd win, and you'd get taken to the next level, And that was cool, but I decided I wanted to have more of a kind of free roaming adventure, overall narrative and structure to it. And so I had started building that into it in the last couple of months of when I was working on that in 2008. And that was great. There were a lot of good things about that, but some of that also really conflicted with the mechanics that I'd already been working on. So it was like, okay, I've got some kind of hard conflicts here. This isn't gelling quite the way I want. I'm a little bit stuck on knowing exactly what I want to do with it. So why don't I work on AI War for a little while? And of course, that consumed everything. And so, in the meantime, I've been thinking a lot about, the problems that I had run into with Alden Ridge, and one of the problems was, straying from the core mechanics a little bit too much of, the trap laying and the fleeing and stuff like that. You've got zombies after you, but you don't have any weapons. That's the premise. But then I introduced weapons, and that didn't feel right at all. And so it's like, okay, maybe we need to take the weapons back out, At this stage, now we've got, a larger team that's going to be working on this, team of four or five anyway. And so right this past week anyway, we've been kind of gearing up to get started back on Alden Ridge for the first time since 2008. And so there's been a lot of discussion. The team has been looking at what I had done before, looking at the first 68 pages of a novel that I had written that was actually what inspired the game in the first place, and looking at, various other ideas. And I've been, talking about the various design changes that I've been wanting to make in the interim, and taking it a little bit more in a roguelike direction, and stuff like that. So there's been a lot of discussion. We haven't fully gelled things yet. I think work on the music and the art is probably going to start right around the start of September, and then probably, with the coding and the level design and getting on into all that sort of thing, we'll probably start right at the end of September, start of October. And then hopefully, we're going to, port all the stuff that was, all that 8 months of other work, you're going to port that and then tear it apart and do a bunch of new stuff in addition to what, kind of the underlying framework had been there, and hopefully we'll be able to finish it in, 4 to 6 months. We'll see. We're thinking about doing some kind of procedural content with it at this stage, which could be kind of interesting, kind of a mix of, handcrafted content and procedural content, because that's something we have a lot of experience with from AI War, and that really is a cool thing for replay value. And I'm playing like Left 4 Dead 2 and stuff. That was something I was really excited about with their. See, this is a good example of when I play somebody else's game and really like what they did, but I'm like, oh, I thought you meant X. See, in Left 4 Dead 2, one of their big things is, oh, we've got the AI director, and he can alter the levels as you go so that it's different every time you go through. And I'm like, that sounds amazing. That's wonderful. And then you wind up playing the same thing several times. You're like, okay, well, you close that door, and then right around the corner, I can just walk through this alley and I'm right where I was going to be already. Well, that's not very different, really. And don't get me wrong, it's an awesome game and I really love it. But that was an idea that, I felt like they had kind of started down a path, but probably for reasons of budget and so forth, didn't fully explore it. And it's like, I would like to fully explore that more. And so that's something that we're thinking about for Alden Ridge. And no promises at the moment because we're still trying to figure out scope and what all we want to do. But I'm excited about it. I think it'll be a really interesting project because there's a lot of work's been invested into it already, and that a lot of that is solid, and we're going to strip out the parts that are not. And then we've got a lot of interesting ideas of kind of how to take that to the next level. Most good games, like most good novels, are not from one good idea. You know what I mean? It's the genesis of several cool ideas that you put together. So we've got some good ideas that are already kind of concretely in there for that game, dating back to 2008. And then we're trying to decide on what the other ideas are that we want to kind of slip in there to really make it where we want it to be.
Yeah, you kind of mentioned you made a good comparison there between games and novels about, you know, the culmination of a lot of ideas. Also kind of important what you take out, you know, as someone who's been a writer myself for a while. I've always kind of described you're a writer, but you're also an editor. You have to be your own editor, and that's probably the
Kill
most
your
important
darlings.
part. What's that?
Exactly. Kill your darlings. Exactly.
I like the term killing babies, but it's a little bit harsher. But yeah, I think Kevin Smith might have been the one who turned me on to that idea. Is there anything, you know, in all of the games that you've done that you've had to take out, you know, maybe like you said, for budget reasons or time reasons, or is there anything that really just that killed you that you didn't want to take out but you had to?
Usually by the time I'm taking something out, I'm like feeling like a surgeon, and I'm like, this has been no end of pain working with this feature, and I'm happy to see it go. As much as I was excited about it at one point, I'm happy to see it go now. I mean, you know, there's endless things you have to take out in every project, and you know, there were just, you know, as many prototypes as Tidalis went through, you know, we just threw them all out, and there was a lot of stuff that we threw out in Tidalis. Even later in the process, we were going to have like horizontal movement of the blocks and stuff, where you could like have the wind blowing the blocks sideways. But that just, you know, just nightmare for the physics of what that would do to it, and mainly for how that would affect the player. Of, you know, if you've got a block straddling two columns, how do you play with that exactly? You know what I mean? How do you line up your shots? It just throws off so much stuff. And so, you know, we took that out. I was a little sorry to see that go. And you know, we took out a number of other things. I mean, we had you know, dozens of ideas that we didn't use, and some that we'd even partially implemented and then took out, like the ability to have two blocks like tied together, for instance. And you know, that caused a lot of problems and didn't really add much to gameplay either. So it's like, okay, that just needs to die. You know, we don't need to invest any more time in this. We've got all these other ideas that are better that we could be investing that time in. You know, because I look at it as kind of like a time bank. You know what I mean? If you've got If I'm going to save some time on aspect X that isn't working out so well, that means I get to use that same time, you know, on aspect Y that might be way cooler, you know, in actual practice. And so, you know, new ideas are always coming up, and I'm not usually too worried about that's never been a problem of like, oh gosh, what are we going to do now? I don't have any more ideas. Like the opposite problem of like, well, this one's not working out, so check that, do this instead. Yeah, so.
Right, no shortage of ideas. Also, I want to ask about another game you guys have coming out called A Valley Without Wind. This one is really intriguing. Can you kind of give people the pitch on what this one is and maybe some info on it?
Sure. It's kind of the idea is it's kind of a tower defense game meets JRPG. That sounds like a weird mix, but I mean, I love doing cross-genre stuff and kind of defying the categorization as much as I can. And with this one, you know, if you think about a JRPG, what do you do in that? You have a story, you've got like some characters or whatever. They, you know, start in some towns or whatever else. You wander around in towns, you go exploring, you talk to people, and then you get into battles. What is the battle like? The battle is almost always that sort of, you know, turn-based Final Fantasy Dragon Quest type thing, right? Or maybe it's action, like, you know, Neverwinter Nights or something, but that's obviously not a JRPG. But you get a few variances, like, you know, Ogre Tactics or you know, Final Fantasy Tactics, where instead they did this really interesting thing, obviously, with having the tactical grid. And so every time you go into a battle, you go into that, and that was a really interesting idea. It's like, wow, okay, this is still a JRPG, but the battle mechanics, which is arguably the core of the game, is like totally not a JRPG. So it's like, well, you know, I really like tower defense games, and I think that having a really smart type of tower defense game where you've got the little guys coming in to they're getting shot up by your towers actually have some AI on them, and okay, you put all your towers on this side of the field because that's where they've been going. Well, then the little guys that are coming in go to the other side of the field because there aren't any towers shooting them up over there. You know, so that the AI, so it's kind of a back and forth then, so that you've actually got an actual battle going on, not, you know, usually tower defense games, as much as I love them, they're kind of puzzle games in terms of the little guys that come in, pretty much, depending on the game, always do about the same thing or react in a predictable way to, you know, how you adjust the field anyway. And instead, having it so that it's emphasizing really different things, not the maze building and not the, you know, trial and error kind of puzzle aspects of it, but instead kind of a, you know, almost strategy-like tactical battle, but instead of walking up and hitting guys, you're setting up defenses and offense-type stuff. And, you know, pairing that with, you know, kind of overall story structure and stuff along the lines of kind of how Chrono Trigger or something is presented. I'm not saying it's a time travel thing, but as far as having, you know, you've got the overworld you wander around on, and then you've got, you know, towns or other areas you go into, and you've got a, you know, a map there that you can wander around on, and you can fight right on the map a lot of times, and, you know, that sort of thing, that general sort of JRPG mechanic. And we're really excited on that. That was something we were going to do sooner than later, but it's like, okay, well, there again, I really want to do that right. And you talked about narrative. That's going to have a really strong narrative. That's part of the whole point of that one. And I just don't know that we as a company could survive the development of a game like that at this point. You know, you have to, you know, there's a lot of dream projects that you can do. You know, you have to wait until the time is right with those. So in the meantime, we've got, you know, our AI War 4.0 version, which is going to have OS X support. We've got our Children of Ninzel expansion for AI War, which is actually a charity thing. Then we've got, you know, the Tidalis stuff that we just did, obviously. We might do, you know, porting of Tidalis to, you know, handheld devices of some sort. Or, you know, we might even consider doing something like Wii or something, but it's kind of early to say with that. You know, and then we've got, you know, Alden Ridge that we're going to be working on, and then we're going to have another expansion, a full expansion to AI War next spring. And then hopefully after that, hopefully the culmination of all those projects will, you know, fund A Valley Without Wind the way that we want to do it. And if not, then we're going to push that back and do something else, you know, that's more appropriate to what we're able to do. And then as soon as we're able to, that's like one of the projects I'm most excited about. But there was kind of the choice of, well, we could do that episodic if we wanted to, so that, you know, you have these smaller chunks of A Valley Without Wind, and that would be one way to kind of avoid the funding issue, you know, because that way people buy it in chunks. But, you know, I don't know. It just feels like you're kind of taking the customer for a ride there a little bit. And, you know, I'd rather be able to make it one cohesive experience rather than this kind of – a lot of the episodic stuff just doesn't grab me. So it's good. It's just you got to know what you're capable of doing. Too many, I've definitely seen indie shops that bit off more than they could chew with a second project or a third project. And, you know, that's the end of you. If you don't have a game to sell and, you know, put all this money and time and effort into this game that's not done, you got to do something for a living. You can't just exist without any pay with this whole staff there for months and months. So that's when shops close. So, you know, my goal is, you know, playing it safe and avoiding that and hitting the projects that are the right size for our company.
one of the last upcoming releases that I wanted to ask you about was a game called Cayenne, just mm-hmm. out of curiosity, just because, you know, unless I'm failing to do my research here as a journalist, I've seen some stuff on A Valley Without Wind that you have on your website and Alden Ridge, but it seems like Cayenne is only maybe like one sentence and a date on your release calendar as to what it is, and I guess you described it as a story-focused, quasi-Japanese-style action RPG, and you can't do that. You can't describe something that interesting and then not give me more details. So so just because I'm curious, I had to ask about that one as well.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I don't think anybody's ever really asked me on that one because there's so many things on our schedule. And yeah, that's about all the information that's public on that. So exclusive news for you then. the tie-in is it's really just the concept stage right now. The story actually is entirely written. It's the first novel I ever actually finished, and like I said, it's not publication worthy. The concept was great, and certainly like my friends and stuff liked it. But I wrote that closing in on the end of high school a long time ago, so I've grown a lot as a writer then, and I recognize all the many problems with the manuscript, and I was not real, I really liked the story. The story was really cool, and what happened in there was really cool. And it's just, the writing was uneven and not where it needed to be and all that. So it's like, well, I don't really feel like rewriting that. This was something I wrote in high school, and it's kind of hard to go back that far and rewrite something. I'm just not in the same place in my life, etc. But the story is really cool, and it would just really make for a really cool, like, Secret of Mana type game. You know what I mean? And so it's like, I could write this as a video game story. I mean, that might sound bad or something, but that's not how I mean it. Video game stories have so much more. They're so different. It's not like writing a novel. With a novel, you have words and that's it, obviously. With a video game, you've got gameplay. You've got the art, you've got the music, you've got all these different things that combine to form the whole narrative, like we were kind of mentioning earlier. So it's like, okay, this could be really interesting, because a lot of the cool thing is with a video game, some of my favorites in particular, like Final Fantasy VI, Chrono Trigger, Secret of Mana, those sort of things, think about how much dialogue is in those games. Yeah, there's a lot of dialogue, but it's not like modern games. It's not like you've got some, 5-minute cutscene with guys rambling on and on for pages at a time. You've got a couple of lines and so forth, and they're just, it's almost like poetry. It's so poignant because of the fact that it's just a couple of lines. So you wind up with them, you get this really poignant feel from those older games where it's, brief on the actual writing, but that kind of empowers the story because of it. And you've got all these other aspects, great art, great music, great, gameplay, combining with those to make an experience that's, just as memorable as a lot of novels and stuff. And I was like, that is what I should do with Cayenne. So it's like, that's what I'm going to do then. So, and it's not going to be like a Secret of Mana clone or anything. I don't mean to say that, because, there's not going to be magic or anything. And one of the big things I want to emphasize is having more interesting swordplay in an action RPG. I really liked how there was such skill-focused swordplay in Zelda 2, The Adventure Link. The Adventure Link from back in the NES days. And obviously, that was a side-scrolling type game. And there's been some other ones like ActRaiser or whatever that have done that, since then. But there haven't been any top-down games that I felt really put a lot of emphasis on, like, shield play and sword play and blocking and multiple moves and stuff. Certainly in the 3D space, you get, like, Prince of Persia or Devil May Cry, various stuff like that that emphasizes that sort of play, but in a 2D space, not so much. So that's one of my goals for that project, is to kind of have that novel type of combat paired with, what was originally a novel, but that would make, much better, video game story.
Excellent. I can't wait. You've been very generous with your time, sir. Thank you for joining me. And if people wanted to download a demo or purchase one of your games, where's the best place they can do that online?
Oh, they can do it right at our site, arkangames.com.
All right, there you have it, guys. Chris, thanks again for coming on with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.